Hello, everybody. This is the second lecture on the neoconservatives. Now, you remember in the course, what we've been doing, we started off with a libertarian group, the old right, that favored the free market and also non-interventionist foreign policy. Among the people in that were Albert J. Nock and H.L. Mencken. And this group opposed American entry into World War II. And then following World War II, we've gone into how the old right was supplanted by the National Review conservatives led by William Buckley. And here, although Buckley said he was a libertarian, he called himself a libertarian at one time, he was a follower of Albert J. Nock. He thought that libertarian principles had to be suspended for the duration of the Cold War, which he expected to last a very long time. We also pointed out that some people, such as James Berman and Wilmer Kendall, made no pretense of being libertarians at all. And then after we went through the National Review conservatives, then we talked last week about another group, the neoconservatives. And the neoconservatives were much closer to the National Review conservatives than to the old right. They were really antithetical in their principles, the old right. And so what we really have in this course is, on the one hand, we have the old right, and then on the other hand, there's the National Review conservatives and the neoconservatives. And while there are certainly differences between National Review conservatives and neoconservatives, some of which we'll discuss today, they were really much closer to each other than either was to the old right. Now, one thing is a bit unusual, that is sort of somewhat of a paradox, perhaps, that about the neoconservatives, is that if you ask people today, what is neoconservatism? If you ask someone who's fairly well informed on what is neoconservatism, they'll immediately think, and they would be right to do this, about people who favor a very aggressive American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. The neoconservatives are allied with the Likud party in Israel. They favor very strongly pro-Israel policy. They're very concerned that the possible danger from Iran, and they propose strong measures if necessary, dropping bombs or even nuclear bombs on Iran to get rid of them. So people associate neoconservatism with this very aggressive foreign policy, and they're right to do that. But as I mentioned last week, what the early neoconservatives like Irving Kristol, who can be considered the founder of the movement, really, Nathan Glaser and Daniel Bell emphasized was domestic policy. So we have, it's not a real contradiction, but we have to explain how it is that a movement that was primarily associated with domestic policy became one that was concentrating on foreign policy. How did this transition take place? And as is often the case with breaks or transitions, it was prefigured early on, because although the early neocons were primarily concerned with domestic policy, they didn't ignore foreign policy at all. They started off as pro-Cold War Democrats. Remember, one thing that had gotten neoconservatism started, even though, as I say, the neocons conservatives tend at first to stress domestic policy, was they didn't like at all the way the Democratic Party was going in the late 1960s and early 70s. The protests against the Vietnam War had gone beyond saying we're in the wrong war in the sense that we're not achieving the goals of American foreign policy, namely stopping the spread of communism at a reasonable cost. Some of the critics were saying American foreign policy is fundamentally misconceived. We haven't just made a mistake in calculation. We've done something fundamentally immoral and wrong in going into Vietnam and causing a great many people to be killed. So the neoconservatives didn't at all approve of these radical critics, and they were especially angry and upset when George McGovern was nominated for president in 1972, because he was in foreign policy allied with what they considered the radical left. He had been a supporter of Henry Wallace in the 1948 election, and they viewed him as somewhat of a communist sympathizer. And these, many of the neoconservatives had supported, or in Senator Henry Jackson of Washington, was called Scoop Jackson, was a very aggressive Cold Warrior, and also supporter of the New Deal. And he was, so they were, and of course, very pro-Israel also. And Scoop Jackson was also very much involved in the movement, was prominent in those days to pressure the Soviet government to allow Jews in Russia to leave Russia in order to go either to Israel or the United States, or at least out of Russia. That was a very strong movement in the late 1970s. And so Scoop Jackson was in favor of that, and then that attracted many of the neoconservatives to him. Now, remember, the neoconservatives, the ones I mentioned, started off as dissident Democrats. They were saying the Democratic Party is not going the right way, it's becoming too radical. We should go back to what I called in the last lecture the Cold War consensus. But when Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, a number of the neocons, led by Kristol, supported him. For some of them, this was the first Republican they'd ever supported in their lives. So Kristol said, well, Reagan is really having the same ideas we do. He doesn't propose to end the New Deal at all. He wants to reform the welfare state pretty much along the lines we do. And he also favors, he's not an appeaser like McGovern, some of the Democrats. He wants to conduct the Cold War in a very vigorous fashion. He talks about the evil empire. We should support him. But Daniel Bell and Nathan Glaser didn't go along with Kristol. So when Kristol and his group included his son, William Kristol, who's become extremely influential among neoconservatives in more recent times, when they supported Reagan, this brought them closer to the National Review conservatives, because the National Review conservatives, at least most of them, were very pro-Ronald Reagan. Incidentally, James Burnham was not that pro-Reagan. He viewed Reagan kind of more of an outsider. He liked more of the Republican establishment types, more kind of more technocratic types. So he was not an enthusiastic Reagan supporter, but some of the neocons were Reagan supporters. Now, one very influential neoconservative was, who William Buckley became friends with was Norman Potteretz, who was the editor of Commentary Magazine. Now, Potteretz had started off as a literary critic. He was a student of Lionel Trilling, who was a famous professor of English at Columbia University. He became Trilling's star student. And then he went to Cambridge University, studied under one of the greatest 20th century literary critics, Frank R. Leavis, the legendary Dr. Leavis. There was also Leavis and his wife was also around, Leavis's wife, who had the name Queenie Leavis. So Potteretz was kind of a leading literary intellectual, and he wasn't at all at that time, this is in the early 1950s, he wasn't a neoconservative then, he was more just a conventional liberal Democrat. But he became the editor of Commentary Magazine, and he became one of the neoconservatives in that he was very upset with this McGovernite trend in the Democratic Party, because one thing, he was very concerned with being pro-Israel. Commentary, it's a magazine of opinion, some of you may be familiar with. I just mentioned, just in passing, Philip Roth once made fun of Commentary because he had in one of his novels, and there's another magazine, kind of a journal called Dissent. So he imagined the two combined, Dissent and Commentary, and came up with Dysentery for the two of them. But the Commentary is a publication of the American Jewish Committee. It has all sorts of articles in it, but it was very strongly pro-Israel. Now, this, when Buckley became friends with Potteretz, this led to a change in National Review foreign policy. In the 1950s, National Review hadn't been especially pro-Israel. It, for example, in 1956, there was Israel and together with Britain and France invaded Egypt in order to seize the Suez Canal. And that was ended when President Eisenhower refused to lend American support to that venture. They had to withdraw. But National Review published an article by Frieda Uttley condemning that attack. There was also an article, incidentally, by Henry Hazlitt in favor of it. But there was an article by Uttley against it, and some of the contributors, especially, for example, James Burnham, who was one of the most, as I mentioned last time, the most influential, I should say, writer on foreign policy, was not at all sympathetic to Israel or Zionism. And in fact, the criticism of Israel had been so noticeable a feature that Leo Strauss, remember we talked about him last time, that we mentioned Bradley Thompson's thesis that Strauss's thought is really the philosophical basis for neoconservatism. But he wrote a letter to the editor of National Review that was published, just a very short letter, criticizing the magazine for lack of sympathy for Israel. And he also wrote at greater length to Wilmore Kendall. Remember we discussed Wilmore Kendall the last time, he was one of the main editors at National Review, senior editor, and he had been Buckley's teacher. So he wrote, and Kendall looked up to Strauss very much and regarded Strauss as one of the greatest thinkers, a great philosopher. So Kendall, Strauss wrote to Kendall complaining about this anti-Israel, what he saw as an anti-Israel bias in National Review. And another thing was, at that time, there's an organization probably most of you have heard of, it's called the Anti-Defamation League. This was set up to investigate a report on anti-Semitic groups, but it extended its range to criticize or to report on right-wing groups. Say the Anti-Defamation League was one that was very concerned with the rise of the John Birch Society and other groups that considered part of the radical right. So Buckley and National Review in the 1950s and 60s had been very critical of the ADL for investigating right-wing groups. They said, well, they're trying to suggest that some of these groups are anti-Semitic, and they're not. It's just that the ADL tends to favor left-wing policies, so they want to smear people that they consider right-wing as possibly anti-Semitic, and they think this is very unfair. But after Poteretz and his wife, who was named Midge Detter, became friendly with Buckley, National Review became much more pro-Israel. So we have when the neoconservatives, such as Crystal, who is, of course, they're all very pro-Israel, start becoming friendly with Buckley and sometimes writing for National Review, then the magazine becomes much more sympathetic than it had been earlier to Israel. And one incident, a kind of famous controversy, that in this transition to more pro-Israel policy by National Review was that Poteretz and Detter strongly attacked Joe Sobrin, who was a longtime National Review contributor and a friend of Buckley. He had been kind of the protege of Buckley, and he was a very good writer. I knew him. He had a very good sense of humor. He's one of the few people I've met who have, in some respects, thicker jokes than I do. I'm not going to tell his jokes because it would get me into big trouble. But he had been a very from an important writer for National Review. In fact, there's a section in National Review that is at the front of the magazine consists of unsigned paragraphs commenting on current events. They'll put in sometimes sarcastic remarks about things. It's kind of a prominent, it's one you see whenever you look at it. Issue of National Review. And Sobrin actually wrote most of that section. So he was probably the most prolific writer for the magazine at one time. But he became very anti-Israel. He thought that the Israeli lobby exercised an inordinate influence on American foreign policy. He wrote very critical of both the American-Israeli lobby and Israeli policy. So Buckley told Sobrin to stop writing about Israel. I think he took him to dinner at one of his favorite restaurants and told him, look, this is going to get us into trouble. People will start saying you're an anti-Semite and the magazine is anti-Semitic, so you better lay off this. And Sobrin had personality where if Buckley was perhaps right that this would get him into trouble if he kept writing this, where at least it was subjecting to attack. Sobrin was not one to back down. He wasn't one who would say, well, I better lay off this as Bill Buckley suggests, because after all, it will get me into trouble. Besides, he's my boss. He could kick me off the magazine. He would more or less kind of just stay with what he wanted to say, and he kept writing about Israel. Eventually, he was fired. He was first, I think, removed as a senior editor and then fired. Now, one person on National Review we haven't talked very much about, it was quite important, especially in the earlier days. I did mention, but we didn't go into his views in much detail, was Russell Kirk. He was a very important conservative theorist of the 1950s. His most famous book was called The Conservative Mind. It's a survey of various writers, starting with Edmund Burke, and considers English and American writers. Some are early not too well known, but one who you might be interested in, if those of you who are libertarians, was a writer called W.H. Mallock, who had some 19th century writer. He had some very good criticisms of socialism, but he had discussions, kind of a very learned book of all sorts of writers. He ended up had T.S. Eliot, the great poet, George Santayana. So he was mainly a literary intellectual, Kurt. And he was a traditionalist. He didn't like, he thought radical change is not a good idea. We should really stick to the wisdom of the past. And although he rarely wrote on foreign affairs, he was opposed to an activist foreign policy. So he wasn't in sympathy with, say, James Burnham or Frank Meyer when they were talking about possible preventive war against the Soviet. He favored kind of a stand pat policy, really didn't. He had been sympathetic to the isolationists in World War II, but he really didn't write much on foreign affairs. But when the neoconservatives came on board in National Review, he really didn't like them at all. So, in fact, in a speech he gave in 1988, he said, this is the quotation from him, "Not seldom has it seemed as if some eminent neoconservatives mistook Tel Aviv for the capital of the United States." So what he's suggesting here is, of course, that the neoconservatives were so pro-Israel that they put the interests of Israel, which after all is a foreign country, ahead of the interests of the United States. So he's really saying these people, these neoconservatives, are not good conservatives. They're not some people we at National Review should align with. But he's really questioning whether their primary loyalty is to the United States. So Midge Detcher, who you remember was Norman Potter's wife, said that Kirk was anti-Semitic because he said that. So Buckley didn't get rid of Kirk, but he was a somewhat older figure, and after a while he kind of faded out. He didn't write that much for National Review anymore. So he was one person who was not sympathetic to the alliance of the neoconservatives and National Review people. He didn't like the neoconservatives. Now, Kirk, it was interesting, he wrote a foreword to, there's actually an excellent critical book about the neoconservatives by Gary Dorian, which was called The Neoconservative Mind. And what's odd about that is not that he would write a book favorable comment on a book critical of the neoconservatives, because as we've said, he didn't like neoconservatives. But Gary Dorian is a theologian who's very pro-socialist in his views. He's very much someone that Kirk would normally oppose, but Kirk was so much against the neoconservatives that he wrote an appreciative foreword to this book. Now, another person who was in kind of the orbit of National Review, there were some other magazines associated with National Review, like Modern Age, which was published by Intercollegiate Individualists. He wrote a lot for this man. Stephen Tonser wrote a lot for modern age. He was an intellectual historian at the University of Michigan. He was an authority on Lord Acton, the great 19th century British classical liberal. He was also very critical of the neocon influence on the National Review conservatives. But despite this opposition from Russell Kirk and Stephen Tonsor, the influence of the neocons at National Review continued. As I say, Buckley was very good friends both with Kristol and Norman Potteret. And also, the neocons, in particular Kristol, another man, Richard Neuhaus. Now, Richard Neuhaus was a Lutheran theologian who eventually became a Roman Catholic priest, and he knew an enormous number of people. He was very influential. So both Kristol and Richard Neuhaus were very influential with foundations like the Scaife Foundation that gave money to conservative writers. So one reason Buckley got along with these people, the National Review got along with these people, the neoconservatives would, if you supported them, they would be able to get money for you. They were very influential. If you attacked them, you wouldn't get money, at least from the foundations that they were had influence on. Now, the people I've talked about so far who were opposed to the neoconservatives wrote from within the National Review circle. Kirk was a longtime contributor to National Review. I think he refused to have his name on the masthead, at least as an editor, because he hated Frank Meyer. He didn't want to be on the same, have his name close to Myers, but he was very much a part of National Review. And Tonsor, although not as prominent, was also in this National Review circle. But there were a number of, especially in the late 1980s, there were a number of traditionalist conservatives who were also opposed to the neocons. And this group became known as the paleoconservatives. Opposition. Neocon is sort of new conservatives, and paleo is old conservatives. So they were called the paleos because of their opposition to the neocons. And these paleos viewed the neocons as not genuine conservatives. As they normally when we think of an adjective, we think of it as a word modifying a noun. They would say somebody's a stalwart conservative, then that's a particular kind of conservative or a rigid conservative. But neoconservative, the prefix neo would suggest it's an adjective, sort of a particular brand type of conservative. But there's another kind of adjective which is not a modifier of the noun it's associated with. Now, remember, you all learn in your English grammar, an adjective is something that modifies a noun. Can anybody tell me how could you have an adjective that doesn't modify the noun? This is a point you'll find useful if you're studying logic or philosophy. Can anybody tell me how would you have an adjective that doesn't modify the noun it's associated with? Does anybody have any ideas on that? A predicate. Charles suggests a predicate. Well, a predicate adjective is still modifying something, like you said, this ball is red. That's red as a predicate adjective, but it's still modifying the noun. Well, the answer, at least the answer I'm looking for, is that you can sometimes have an adjective that cancels the noun rather than modifies it. Supposing we say something like that, something is an artificial flower. An artificial flower isn't a particular kind of flower, say we say a sweet smelling flower, that would be a particular sort of flower. But an artificial flower isn't a kind of flower at all. It's not a flower. Say if we say something is a rubber duck isn't a duck that's made of rubber. A rubber duck isn't a physical object that is shaped to resemble a duck, but it isn't a duck at all. So the paleos set would say neocon, the neo is an adjective withdrawing the force of conservatism altogether. So it's saying neocon is not a conservative, something like an artificial flower. It's not neoconservative at all. Now, many of the paleos, although not all of them, were Southerners who wanted to preserve the traditional Southern way of life. They'd been critical, say, of the civil rights movement and affirmative action. They favored states' rights. And among these were Mel Bradford, who was a professor of English at the University of Dallas, I talked about a little bit last time. And another was Sam Francis, who was a historian. He specialized in early modern diplomatic history. He was mainly known as a political analyst, specializing in foreign policy. And another was Clyde Wilson, who's a great authority on the John C. Calhoun. He was the editor of John C. Calhoun's papers, a very strong proponent of the Southern position in the Civil War. I'm sure he would call it the War of Northern Aggression. And then Tom Fleming, who was another strong Southerner, he'd written for the Southern Partisan. He was the editor of a magazine called Chronicle. Now, one person associated with them who was not a Southerner was Paul Gottfried, who was an intellectual historian specializing in European conservatism, written on 19th century German conservatism. And I knew all of these people, and Gottfried, who I'm still in touch with, is really the one who hated the neoconservatives the most. He thought some of them had kept him out of a position he was going to get at the Catholic University of America. And he really hates the neocons with a passion. And he'll always say, what they did to me. And if you ask him, well, what did they do to you, he'll tell you at very great length what they did to him. So he was one who hated the neocons. Now, one thing you might find a bit strange, I misspelled for, it should be F-O-R, but Sam Francis was a leading disciple of James Burnham, so you might wonder, well, wouldn't Francis then be inclined to support the neocons because Burnham favored a very aggressive Cold War policy and so do the neocons? Well, you remember, Burnham was very critical of Israel. He was anti-Zionist. So Sam Francis, who was Burnham's disciple, was also very critical of the neocons. Now, during the late 1980s and early 1990s, the paleos were allied with Murray Rothbard's group of libertarians. So we have this alliance really, in a sense, revived the old right. Remember, in the old right, the libertarians like Nock and Mencken had allied with some of the conservative Republicans, including Herbert Hoover, whom they previously criticized in an effort to bring down the New Deal. So here we have, there were some libertarians that led by Rothbard who were allied with the Paleo. So this was kind of a revival of the old right. And there was a conference held at the Rockford Institute, which is the group that supports this magazine Chronicles that Tom Fleming edits, to set up this alliance. I was there when I was in that conference. I can tell you, I remember it very well. And what the hope was that we could form some kind of a new movement that would oppose the neocons and also oppose certain trends in the Libertarian Party that Rothbard was against. And a group called the John Randolph Club, which is still around, was established to support these paleo ideas. One very prominent political figure who was associated with the Paleo Alliance was Pat Buchanan, who ran for president a couple of times. And he's been a television commentator and journalist for a very long time. And he had a great deal of respect for Murray Rothbard. In fact, all of the Paleos, all the ones I mentioned earlier, respected Rothbard very greatly. Now, Pat Buchanan is another person who got into trouble with the Buckley and the National Review circle after Buckley allied with the neocons. Because in the Gulf War of 1991, remember where the U.S. invaded Iraq, Iraq under Saddam Hussein had first invaded Kuwait, and then the U.S. launched a massive attack on Saddam Hussein, although they didn't bring down the regime of Saddam Hussein at that time. They just reversed their conquest of Kuwait and did a great deal of damage to the Iraqi forces. So Buchanan had opposed that war, and he referred to what he called the Amen Corner of people who were supporting the war. So Poteretz and other neocons attacked Buchanan as anti-Semitic because they thought he was suggesting that really America had gone to war just to help Israel. So Buckley, in a writing in National Review, criticized Buchanan. He said he thought there was a considerable substance to the neoconservative charges of anti-Semitism against Buchanan. So this is another person who had been associated with National Review for a long time, was kind of forced out after this alliance of the neocons and the National Review people. Now, after Murray Rothbard died in January 1995, the Paleo Alliance, that's say this alliance between the Paleo conservatives and the Murray Rothbard libertarians, really ended. And why was it? Well, although the Paleos were very respectful of Rothbard, they really didn't like libertarianism very much, especially the free market. They weren't socialists, but at the same time, they weren't strong supporters of the free market either. Many of them supported protective tariffs, not all of them, many of them did, because they were believe we have to build up the American nation, that foreign countries don't really matter that much. We have to build up support for American industry. Now, of course, there are good arguments that if you want to support American industry, tariffs aren't a good idea. They interfere with the division of labor. They make people worse off, but they weren't convinced by these arguments. There are also personality conflicts. One that's kind of amusing is that if in certain aspects is that Tom Fleming is someone, I know him, I get along with him, but he can be extremely hard to get along with. So most alliances would involve Tom Fleming don't last very long. I remember one story Fleming told me was he was once teaching at a university faculty, and it was a faculty meeting. So one person became so incensed by what Fleming was saying that he jumped across the table in order to attack him. So Fleming was somebody who could really get arguments into the punching stages very readily. And he, incidentally, had a big falling out with Richard Neuhaus. You remember the neocon who knew all the influential people in the foundation. So he and Fleming had a big falling out earlier. Now, what about the neocons' views on foreign policy? Well, throughout the Cold War, the neocons urged a confrontational policy with the Russians. They said it should be better against the Russians. And Poterets went so far as to criticize Reagan for being too soft on the Russians. It's kind of peculiar because Reagan was the one who was saying, we've got to combat, bring down the evil empire. But Poterets said, well, he's not going far enough. Really has these making sometimes he's talking about disarmament. This would be a very bad idea. We have to really build up our armaments and really let the Russians have it if necessary. We can't have any concessions to them. So, as I say, the neocons were supporting this very aggressive policy in the Cold War. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, the neocons had a problem, which is the U.S. won the Cold War, the Soviet Union dissolved, but the neocons favor an aggressive foreign policy. It isn't just they want to be aggressive against Russia. They like the idea of having an aggressive foreign policy. Remember last time we were talking about Leo Strauss, who and his influence, some of the Straussians have the idea if you can promote war from time to time, it's a good way to build up virtue among the people. People will be more inclined to sacrifice for the common good instead of being preoccupied with their own selfish pursuits. So the neocons needed a new target for an attack. They can't devote their primary attention to the Soviets anymore. And we can see, if you look at a book by Poterets called World War IV, that he liked the sense of unity present in the American people during World War II. Remember, he grew up when World War II was going on. He was a very young man at that time. So Irving Kristol and some of the others were growing up at that time. And they liked the people were united in America at that time. They said, well, we've got to defeat Germany and Japan. So they liked this sense of unity. And they were thinking, how could this be recaptured? I should say, to explain the title of World War IV, World War III is the Cold War. World War IV is the war against terrorism. So how could the sense of unity be recaptured? How could we get back this sense of unity that we had during World War II? Well, Poterets suggests a war against what he calls Islamo-fascism. Now, he didn't originate this position, but it's become very influential among the neocons at war against Islamofascism. So what does Islamofascism mean? Well, the claim is that there's a worldwide terror campaign against the United States, which is based in large part on an interpretation of Islam that calls for world dominance by Islam. Now, this is not a course on Islamic theology, fortunately for me, because it's not a subject among the many subjects I don't know anything about, but there are some passages in the Quran that suggest unbelievers have to be conquered, or there has to be a struggle against unbelievers. So there are people who interpret those passages to mean this is kind of, we have to go out and really fight against unbelieving nations and bring them into the sphere of Islam. And of course, there are many other people who are Muslims who don't have that view, take it more kind of a spiritual struggle. But in the view of those who are talking about the threat of Islamofascism, they tend to emphasize the passages of the Quran that suggest armed struggle. They think people who hold those views among Muslims are very important and influential. Now, where is the fascism part of the word Islamofascism comes from? Well, during World War II, there were some Arab leaders like the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He's a kind of religious figure, judge, was actually appointed by the British government to this position, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was very pro-Hitler in his views. There were others as well. I think Anwar Sadat during World War II had been rather sympathetic to the Nazis. So what Poteritz wanted to suggest was this wasn't just something in the past that the Muslim leaders today are really still influenced by the fascist and Nazi models. Again, Poteritz is someone who wants to refight World War II, so he says, well, you know, we had fascism, we were fighting fascism then, so now Cold War is over, we have to fight these Islamofascists. And the people who want to campaign against Islamofascism usually target the government of Iran as their main country they want to overthrow, because after all, Iran is run by the cleric Shia Muslim clerics, and they say this is what we mean by Islamofascism. Now, as you might suspect, there are quite a few difficulties with this theory. One was it really ignores the issue whether terrorism is a response to American policy. After all, the U.S. is very heavily involved in the Middle East in ways that many Muslims don't like. Say the U.S. is very pro-Israel, the U.S. is stationed troops in Saudi Arabia, and many Muslims think they shouldn't have non-Muslim troops in the holy places, places that are holy to Islam. So America has done all sorts of policies that many Muslims don't like, so it seems plausible to think that the terrorist incidents are responses to American policy, but the proponents of the Islamofascist view don't view it that way. They say, no, it's just they don't like America. America is really, for them, the great enemy because it's a very prosperous non-Islamic state. So they're assuming that the terrorists aren't responding to American foreign policy, but they're just opposed to America because America isn't under Islamic law. Now, another thing that should be considered in addition to this point about how much the terrorist acts or the responses to American policy is that most of the terrorist acts actually happen among Islamic countries themselves. Most of them aren't have been directed to the U.S. Of course, the September 11th one was a spectacular exception, but after all, it is an exception. There weren't a series of other terrorist acts after the September 11th attack. So the extent of the terrorist campaign directed against the U.S. has been considerably exaggerated by the supporters of the Islamo-fascism view. Now, there's a problem, or at least a tension, for this people who say there's a menace from Islamo-fascism, and that's the principal ideology we have to combat, because this ideology is saying we've got to overthrow America and other governments in order to bring them under Islamic rule. And the people who think that, it's claimed, have supported a terrorist campaign against us. So the tension is that the people who have this view also supported the Iraq War of 2003. And the problem here is that the Saddam Hussein regime was not a proponent of militant Islam, but separated religion and state. So you'd think if you were going after Islamo-fascism, you wouldn't really want to invade Iraq. Iran might be your target, but not Iraq, but they did support the war in Iraq anyway. Now, in fact, there was a group called the Project for the New American Century, and this group lasted from 1997 until 2006. This strongly favored the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein government. And the group was founded by William Crystal. Remember, I mentioned him a number of times before. He's the son of Irving Crystal. He's someone who's very interested in foreign policy. He's been kind of prominent in American politics for a long time. He studied at Harvard with Harvey Mansfield, who was a leading Straussian. And the other founder of this Project for the New American Century was Robert Kagan, who's also an important writer on foreign policy and a leading neocon. Kagan has written a book arguing that I mentioned in earlier lectures that there was an American tradition of non-intervention in European power politics, and the old right said we should go back to. So Kagan has written a book saying, no, there was no such tradition. America has always been a aggressive interventionist power. So I did a review of that book. I was less than enthusiastic about it, but he's a leading neocon foreign policy theorist. So besides supporting failing the overthrow of Saddam Hussein government, the group also called for increased military spending in order to maintain American world dominance. And said, well, if America has to keep up our superiority over other nations, so then other nations won't be a threat to us. We just have to keep spending more and more money on armaments so we can continue to be the dominant power. Now, I want to discuss now, go into a little more detail about some of the neocon position on foreign policy. We examine a book that was published in 2003, shortly before the Iraq War broke out. And the book is by Lawrence Kaplan and William Crystal. It was called The War Over Iraq, Saddam's Tyranny and America's Mission. Now, as the title suggests, the main reason we're supposed to overthrow Saddam was that he was a tyrant. And they mention a lot of atrocity stories, that things that Saddam did. They didn't stress as much the weapons of mass destruction that he was alleged to have. It was more, he was a tyrant, we should overthrow him. Now, there's a problem, or at least several problems here, is it's plausible to think Saddam was a tyrant, but why does that imply the United States should overthrow him? I mean, there are tyrants all over. Should we overthrow all of them? And also, what does Saddam have to do with the alleged threat from Islamofascism? As I mentioned, he wasn't a supporter of militant Islam. He was in the context of the Arab world more of a secularist. So the question they have is, well, why, okay, he's a tyrant, but why should we want to get rid of him? And what Kaplan and Crystal appeal to what's called democratic peace theory. So, and this is the view that some political scientists hold. They claim that democracies never go to war with each other, that all wars involve conflicts between states that either aren't democracies, or if there is a democracy, it's not at war with another democracy. And one of the main supporters of this view is a Yale political scientist named Bruce Russett. So the idea of democratic peace theory is, well, since democracies never go to war with each other, and if we can just get democracies all over the world, then we will have lasting peace, because democracies never go to war with each other. All we have to do is get democracies in place. Now, it's interesting, Russett, although he supported democratic peace theory, he earlier wrote a defense of American isolationism in World War II. It's a short book called No Clear and Present Danger. It came out in 1972. That's actually an excellent book. I recommend that. So it's a bit odd that he's supporting, first supporting isolationism, and then he's changed to support democratic peace theory. So what the argument of the Kaplan Crystal was, if democracies could be established all over the Middle East, then peace would be assured. And here's where Islamofascism comes in, because they thought, well, if democracies were established, then radical Islam of this type they oppose would lose its popular appeal, because then democracies would be, say, just like the United States. People wouldn't be interested in these extreme religious movements anymore. They would be people really just like us. So now, I see A.L. Spencer anticipated my next slide, because he said, did that not set the template for Egypt, Libya, and now Syria. Well, the neocons were proposing not just war with Iraq, but a whole series of war. A.L. Spence is quite right. So this is really what Charles Beard called perpetual war for perpetual peace. So the idea, well, democracies don't go to war with each other, so we have to go to war with all these non-democratic states and get them to be democracies. So it's a formula for peace that leads to a great many wars. So we first have to ask, well, is it true that democracies never go to war? We can certainly find exceptions to that. For example, in the American Civil War, both the North and South could be considered democracies, at least by 19th century standards, and they were at war with each other. Now, Matthew said, didn't England go to war with Finland? I don't know that England ever declared war against Finland. Of course, Finland had sent troops to some troops to help the Axis probably. I don't know that England declared war on them. I don't think so. I mean, I could be wrong. I don't think so. But I think the main problem with the democratic peace theory is not so much that we can find some exceptions to generalization. Democracies never go to war with each other. But the question we have to consider is, and this again is a point I think applied not just to this course, but it's an important distinction that will help you if you're interested in philosophy. We have to ask, are we dealing with an empirical generalization or a proposition that will support a counterfactual? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, supposing it's the case that democracies haven't gone to war with each other, say, we look at the past and maybe we can find a few exceptions, but it doesn't look like democracies go to war with each other. So, for this project that the neocons do, makes sense. What they're saying is, well, since democracies don't go to war with each other, what we have to do is establish democracies all over the world, and then they won't, these new states won't go to war with each other. So for that to be true, it needs to be true that if democracies were to be established, they wouldn't go to war with each other. So what we're starting with, we say, well, existing democracies haven't gone to war with each other. But what the proponents of democratic peace theory said, this isn't just a generalization, it isn't just saying things have happened this way, but we have a law. Remember, a law is something that supports a counterfactual. Let's give a simple example. Suppose I say it's a law of physics that two bodies will attract each other with a certain gravitational force. That isn't just saying that such and such bodies in the past have attracted each other with this gravitational force. It said, if we were to have two bodies, they would attract each other. So the law is something that supports a counterfactual. And for democratic peace theory to be correct, it is enough to say if democracies haven't gone to war with each other, we need to know, is it true that if democracies were to be established in all these countries, then they wouldn't go to war with each other? So that's a much stronger claim. That's a counterfactual. That thing's not just happened to work out that way some in the past, but it's going to continue in other circumstances to be that way. Now, sometimes people who support democratic peace theory, they appeal to the great philosopher Immanuel Kant. Of course, objectivists wouldn't think he's such a great philosopher, but nevertheless, I think the objectivists are wrong. But Kant said in a short work called Perpetual Peace, he thought that if we have a popular elected legislature that had to approve a war, then wars would be less likely. You wouldn't have cases, say, where a ruler could just say, I'm committing the people of this country to war, and that then they have to fight, if you had to get the war approved by a popularly elected legislature, then wars would be less likely. But I don't think this could be used as an argument for support of democratic peace theory, because in modern democracies, the executive, as in happened in the U.S., we see this since the Korean War, the executive very often starts wars without legislative approval. Now, there's a further problem for the neocons when they want to talk about this threat from Islamic fascism. What happens if the majority of the population favors an Islamic regime? The neocons assumed that the people they favored would win, so they really, when you talk about establishing democracies, they really mean regimes of a sort they approve of, but when the democratic peace theorists talk about democracy, they mean democracy in the sense of majority rule countries. So you could have, and this has happened, say in the elections in Palestine, and very often supported strongly pro-Islamic parties like Hamas, of the type that the neocons consider examples of Islamo-fascism. So this is another problem for the use by the neocons of democratic peace theory. Now, the notion of revolutions that are guided to achieve a particular outcome, so which the neocons are saying, well, we want to have support these revolutions, but they have to be ones that are democracies in the kind we like. That's reminiscent of the wars of the French Revolution, also the communist revolutions in Europe after the Bolshevik Revolution, where we had in each case there was a powerful country, France and Russia, were saying, well, we want to have sponsored revolutions, but they're revolutions who are subordinate to us. And I suggest, in conclusion, we see kind of the mindset. Remember, the early neocons, like Erwin Christoph, and started off as Trotsky, I supported Leon Trotsky, had the idea of a world revolution. So we see really that this Trotskyite mindset is really continues among these later neocons, not in the sense they want to support socialist or communist revolution, but they want to still support worldwide revolutions. Now it's democratic revolutions instead of communist revolutions, but still world revolutions kind of a sort controlled by a central nation. So I think I'll stop now and we can have the rest of the time for questions and objections, comments. See anybody have anything? Let me just open the Q&A. I think if people are putting it in the chat, but I'll put the okay. Well, let's see. Here's one here. Alex says, "What faction of libertarians did Rothbard ally against with the paleocon?" Well, he thought that the Libertarian Party at that time had been taken over by people who had what he considered radical cultural ideas. Rothbard was a kind of a cultural conservative, and he thought that there were people in the Libertarian Party that we called space cadets, that was who were kind of really bohemians and opposed to traditional values, say people who didn't like the conventional family or who were strong drug users. And he really, Rothbard's personal attitudes were opposed to those people, so he was against them. I don't think it's a particular person or group that he aligned with, but he thought that the Libertarian Party was really trying to suggest that libertarianism was really part of a larger movement, kind of a social protest, say, against bourgeois morality. And we see this today, you know, there's a movement called left libertarianism, and we have all, on the other hand, there's more conservative style libertarianism, such as that Hans Hoppe professes. So it's sort of a similar struggle to that. Hans Hoff, incidentally, was involved in this Paleo Alliance, but some of the Paleos turned against him because Hans wrote a paper on San Francis that was rather suggestive, deliberately Randolph, suggesting that San Francis was teaching what he called social fascism, and then Tom Fleming got very upset about that. Yes, A.O. Friend says, I think that most people associate libertarian with liberty. Yes, there are people who do that. I mean, Ayn Rand was one who suggested that, but this is exactly what Rothbard was trying to oppose in his Paleolog. Rothbard was saying, no, you can be a libertarian and have quite conservative cultural values. You don't, say, have to approve of all the latest trends in that the more left-wing people support in morality. So he didn't support such things. So, and he wanted to make sure that libertarianism wasn't natural. That's it. In his view, a libertarian is someone who accepts the non-aggression axiom, doesn't favor the initiation of force, who supports the free market, private property, but you don't have to accept other things as well, like, say, support, say, for freeing up people's moral values from what are viewed as outdated religious restraints. You don't have to hold such a view. So on many issues of that kind, Rothbard was not sympathetic to the more liberal position, liberal in the modern sense. Let me see here. Andrew says, you said that neocons ignore the argument that terrorism could be a reaction to U.S. policy. Do they really ignore it? Do they answer indirectly by denying the U.S. could ever be at fault by calling it blaming the victim? And that's a very good point you make. I accept what you say. When I said ignore it, I should have said more ignore the force of the argument rather than say nothing at all about it. They didn't have it in mind when they were formulating their doctrine, but I mean, in response to criticism, say, by Ron Paul and others who said, well, U.S. policies provoke that, they say, well, if you say that, you're really trying to justify their policies. You're saying the U.S. is really responsible, so they're saying they're justifying what they did. Of course, that isn't the case, because if you explain something causally, if you say, this is what brought it about, that isn't to say that it's the correct thing for them to do. It isn't to say, supposing that U.S. policy, say, stationing troops in Saudi Arabia led to the 9/11 attacks, if that's part of the explanation. That isn't to say that the 9/11 attacks were justified, if you think that, but that's a distinction that they tend to ignore. But your point is a very good one. Charles said, how did the old GOP establishment, what Rothbard calls the Rockefeller World Empire, put into the dynamic of the neocons down into the Republican Party, people like George H.W. Bush, Brent Scowcroft, Henry Kissinger, Dick Brzezinski, etc. Well, I would say the neocons tended to view the Rockefeller people as really a bit old hat, not going far enough. They would say, in fact, one of the points that the neocons made was that people like Kissinger and Brzezinski are interested in traditional European-style politics. They reduce foreign policy questions really to questions of power. And the neocons said this is really ignoring the force of ideology. They're more interested in spreading this democratic world revolution. Now, there are some neocons who aren't, and some of the Straussians aren't in sympathy with democratic world revolution, but the ones who are would say these Rockefeller-style people are too bound by the old ways of doing things. And one of the things, in fact, they criticized Scowcroft and the first George Bush for was that they after the Gulf War, they didn't get rid of Saddam Hussein. They left him in place. So the neocons, at least the ones I was talking about in this lecture, said he was a big mistake. That was a big mistake. They should have gotten rid of them. Jeff says, in omnipotent government, media is critical of France's interwar lackluster hostility in Nazi Germany. So the Nazis could have been stopped with a militant policy. Are you familiar with it? Yes, I do know that. Would Mises have agreed with Ron Paul's foreign policy? Mises sounds neocons in that passage about France. Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, it's hard to say what he would have said about contemporary foreign policy. But you're right, he was not someone who was a supporter of the isolationist viewpoint about World War II. In fact, I wrote Mises a letter once asking him what he thought of A.J.P. Taylor's book, Origins of the Second World War, which is kind of a revisionist view of World War II origin. I asked him that about another book, and he answered me, let me see if I could quote the letter. He said, the writers you mention in your letter misrepresent the facts in every regard. It appears they have never read Mein Kampf. I was surprised when I was going through, one time they have files of Mises' papers at the Mises Institute. I was surprised he had kept my letter, which I wrote, you know, when I was a student at UCLA. He kept that letter from would be around 1967. He kept that in his files. I was surprised by that. So I think you're right. He was not a particularly supportive non-intervention, but I don't know what he would have said about current events. I mean, he might have said, well, it's a different situation. I might have thought, well, Hitler really was a big danger, but that isn't to say that every country that's represented as being a danger really is one. I think I missed anybody. No. Now, Alex said, was the John Birch Society considered part of the neocons? Oh, no, definitely not. See, the John Birch Society tended to be very sympathetic to non-interventionist foreign policy. They thought the danger from communism was largely internal. And they got along very well with some of the libertarians. Hans Senholz was lecturer. Ludwig von Mises was on the editorial Advisory Board of American Opinion, which was the John Birch Society magazine, as a matter of fact. So they would be very strong, the Birch Society would be very strongly opposed to the neocons, and they continue to be opposed to them today. Charles says, what is your opinion on Justin Raimondo's book on the old right and the menace of the neocons? I think that's a very good book. You know, if you look at the reissue of that book that was published by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the ISI, I have an essay in that book. It's kind of a foreword to the book, but I think there are two other people also wrote essay where I go into Justin's book. And Justin was very much a follower of Murray Rothbard. His interpretation is really quite along the lines of Rothbard. So I think it's an excellent book. I remember when it first came out, and I think very highly of Justin, because he's very well informed on contemporary foreign policy. I've known him a long time. I guess when you get old, you know a lot of people for a long time. At least that's happened to me. Okay, now, while we're waiting for another question, I just want to go over, does everybody get this distinction between an empirical generalization and a law, which is a statement that will support a counterfactual? That's a very important thing, to a philosophical concept to grasp. It'll be a great help to you if you study philosophy. So does every, you know, I mentioned this when I talked about democratic pieces, does everyone understand that, or do you have any questions about that? Doug said, did Rothbard support Buchanan in the 1992 presidential campaign? Yes, he did. Yes, I mean, he didn't agree with some of his views, especially in economic policy, but he did support Buchanan. Buchanan and Rothbard got along very well. I think after that, I mean, Rothbard tended to be critical of Buchanan's economic policy, but he thought very highly of Pat Buchanan, and he did support him. Here's another thing, wait a sec here. Charles, as you mentioned, Russell Kurt, he has a very well-known book, The Conservative Mind. What do you think of that book? Well, I talked about that a bit in the lecture. I think it's a very good literary study of various figures. You know, I mentioned he has W.H. Mallock, he has others, George Gissing, the novelist George Santayana, T.S. Eliot, George Saintsbury. He has all sorts of people. The problem with Kirk is he tends not to be a terribly analytical writer. He doesn't give much in the way of arguments. He'll just summarize what people said. But it's a very good study of these particular writers. So I think it's a good book. I don't think you'd be able to get a coherent political philosophy out of it, but I think it's certainly a book that's well worth reading. I think Kirk is somebody. Now, it's interesting, Kirk, you know, he's very pro-British. In fact, he thinks the American Revolution was a mistake, but he tends to support kind of a very pro-British view of American history. He's a very interesting writer, though. I think you should certainly read him. Now, Jeff says, please review Counterfactual. All right, well, Counterfactual is something saying what is saying what would happen if under certain conditions. So suppose what's the difference? Suppose I say, let's say, the U.S. and France today, let's say, are democracies. So I say, as an example of the proposition, democracies don't go to war with each other. The U.S. and France don't go to war with each other. Now, let's say, what would be a good case here? Let's say China and Iran are not democracies. So a counterfactual would be if China and Iran were to become democracies, then they wouldn't go to war with each other. See, they're not democracies now, but if they were to become democracies, then they would go to war with each other. Now, if you have a scientific law that says, suppose you say democracies don't go to war with each other, if you say it's a scientific law, then you'd be making the claim not only is it true of actual cases, but it will hold true of case of other cases that don't exist now. So in order to be a scientific law, it has to support a counterfactual. So and I'm suggesting this is a problem for democratic peace theory of the sort that says democracies don't go to war with each other. So if we establish democracies all over the world, they wouldn't go to war with each other. So that doesn't follow logically from the first statement, because the first statement says, well, just in existing democracies haven't gone to war with each other. But this is making a further claim. If we were to set up democracies where they don't now exist, it would be the case that these new democracies wouldn't go to war with each other. So that's a quite a bit stronger claim. Now, Charles says that very many libertarians, particularly Rothbardian variety, become neocons. I'm thinking particularly of Williamson Evers, always behind that story. Well, I don't think that Bill Evers would consider himself a neocon. I think his view of his own activities, I mean, one could question whether he's deceiving himself, but he thinks he can get Rothbardian ideas in by trying to become influential in the Republican Party. And I think he considers himself kind of a secret, sort of covered Rothbardian. He thinks he hasn't changed his views all that much. I think critics of Evers would think he has, but I think that's the way he views himself. But I really don't know why he changed his view. He did go, I mean, why he allied with the Republicans. He went over in Iraq, and he was involved in the administration of education over there during the Iraq War. I'm quite sure Rothbard would have been very upset by that, but I guess he did that, though. Now here's something else here. Max, also in terms of counterfactual, I know Holtzman holds that economics made up of counterfactual. Is this view controversial among Austrian economists today? Well, I think all Austrian economists would think that laws have counterfactual force, but I think I have to go over exactly what Guido says about these, but I think in the way she takes it, he does it in a way that is controversial. But I have to go over exactly what he says to get what's controversial about it. But it's in general the case that a scientific law will hold not just in the actual world, but if things were different, it would continue to hold. But I think Guido goes further than that. And I think one thing he thinks is that long when economists are talking about long-term consequences, they really mean to be talking about some counterfactual state of affairs, and I'm not sure he's always right about that. I think he is in some cases, but I have to go over what he says about that to give you a good answer to that. Well, does anyone have a last point? I think we're about out of time now, so anyone has a last question or so? Now, if not, I have another quiz for you, this is the last lecture of the course, and I want to thank everyone for coming to my course. It's been a small group, I like to think a very select group, and you've been a very good students. And thanks very much for coming to my course, and I hope we'll see you in future courses. And thanks very much, and I hope we'll see some of you again. Thanks a lot. Okay. Thanks very much. Bye, everybody.